Well, Bill, again, thanks a million for all of your, all the time you've given us, and this is certainly appreciated. Listen, I want to jump right into it. We've got a number of things going on in the National Football League. I don't want to get overzealous here and overstate it, but I'm very concerned about something that has been insinuated strongly anyway, and that is the possibility of paying to lose ball games. Now, that could destroy football as we know it. I mean, I hate to be that, but it could be huge. And of course, Brian Flores and Hugh Jackson both had different stories. Now, interestingly enough, Bill, I had Hugh Jackson on this program yesterday, and while he insinuated and maybe skirted around the edge, he didn't really explain all that he had to someone else that I was aware of. But this is serious business. I'm sure you're aware and concerned about it. Where do you think it's going from here? And one other thought. I find it very, very interesting that the media, as much as they like to jump on a Watergate story, the media has not really jumped on this. My own personal feelings are, I can't buy it, but somebody that would own a franchise, be as wealthy as they are and take a chance on losing everything they've got plus a franchise, talking about something that off base with someone who they're probably going to end up firing at some point. I just can't see that. I can't fathom any way that could happen. But anyway, your thoughts on the whole situation there?
Well, I agree with you. I think it's deplorable. I think you have to divide the issue into two. It's been characterized as tanking, but there's really two parts to it. And the first was, to my knowledge, started by the Philadelphia 76ers and a general manager whose name I can't recall. And it's probably good that I can't, because he should be buried in the ash heap of history, who started something called The Process. He was an analytics guy, a Wall Street guy. And he said the only way to get to win a championship in the NBA is to gut your team, finish last for 2 or 3 years, however long you have to do that, until you can get a transformational player or two who will change your team. The thinking, and Larry Bird has validated this for me. I mean, if you have three superstars, you can win a championship in the NBA. So the idea of this process, started by the Philadelphia 76ers, was to gut the team, gut it of talent, put non-entities on the court, lose as many games as you could. He made no bones about it. The GM made no bones about it. And then go ahead and win the draft lottery, and put yourself in a position where you can get these transformational players. One of them happened to be Ben Simmons, who's no longer happy, doesn't want to be there anymore. I guess the only good one they got out of him was Embiid. Out of the whole process was Embiid. It was so toxic in the city of Philadelphia because this guy made no bones about it. He came right out and said it, talked about it in Sports Illustrated in a big article. This is the way to the future. This is the way to do it. And as a result, lost his job. And they brought in Elton Brand, former Duke great and NBA player, to head up the basketball operations. Now, Morey is there now. Daryl Morey from the Houston Rockets is there now. And he's kind of a middle-of-the-road analytics guy, if you will. He's the one that invented James Harden dribbling the ball for 23 seconds and then shooting while everyone else stands around. I don't know, you know, it wasn't fun to watch, and they didn't win anything, but I guess it's a theory. In any event, the Houston Astros did the very same thing in baseball. They gutted their roster. They lost over 100 games for 2 years, I believe, and got the rights in the draft to Carlos Correa, their shortstop, and rebuild it to a, quote, world championship, close quote, team. Obviously, you know, there are other issues surrounding the Astros. It's happened in football most recently with the Cleveland Browns, not with the Hugh Jackson situation, but they did gut the roster. They brought analytics people in there, not Andrew Berry, who's there now, but some other people, and they gutted the roster. And when Hugh Jackson was there, I think they were 1-30 or something like that, some terrible record, and got the rights to draft Garrett from it with the first pick in the draft, and he's turned out to be great. And the following year, to draft Baker Mayfield, and he hasn't turned out to be so great. And they made one playoff since, I believe. Now, that's Ryan Flores said that he went to Miami knowing full well that they were going to gut the roster, that they were going to completely rebuild, and there might be some losing involved. But he said he'd never agreed to deliberately lose games. And he claims, makes an allegation that the owner offered him money to lose games. That's where the dividing line comes in. I hate the former. I hate the process. I think that cheats the fans. It cheats the players. It cheats the coaches. It's wrong. But it's not illegal under the rules of the National Football League or the NBA or Major League Baseball. It's wrong, but not illegal. I'm glad the guy in Philadelphia got fired. And I never want to see anybody fired in the National Football League, and it certainly wasn't Hugh Jackson's fault because he didn't have a roster to play with. And the same is true, by the way, in Houston, where David Culley got fired for winning four games with a roster that most people thought couldn't win one. So, you know, but that's not illegal. It may be distasteful to some, including me and you, but it's not illegal. What is illegal, both legally under the laws of the United States and within the rules of virtually every professional sport, is to offer money to do such a thing. And that's at issue in the Flores case. As you correctly state, Hugh Jackson sort of tap dances around the issue. And so there's no proof that he was ever given money by the Haslam family, which is what he originally alleged, to lose. But if this allegation is true in the Flores case, and it will be investigated by the NFL, then that's an entirely different issue, entirely different issue. So on the one hand, the process, if you will, of gutting a team and rebuilding it through the draft is not illegal. It's distasteful to some. But offering money to a coach or a player or anyone else to deliberately lose games is a completely different story. That's illegal both under the laws and under the Constitution and bylaws of the NFL. So it's important to bifurcate and understand the two. We'll see what happens. There'll be an investigation, that's for sure. There may well be a court case. We'll find out. I don't know. I don't have any feeling one way or the other there, except that Coach Flores did a pretty good job with the roster that he had. But we'll see where that goes. The other part of it is the answer to that is a draft lottery. If you want to discourage people from gutting their rosters and trying to build it up by getting the top choice or top two choices in the draft, then you go ahead and have a draft lottery. And the NFL probably ought to think about that at some point in the future. I prefer what we have now, because there are times like my last year in Indianapolis when we lost Peyton Manning, lost Kerry Collins, and lost quite a few other starters to injury, in Manning's case and Collins' case for the year. We ended up 2-14, and they did get the first pick in the draft, which turned out to be Andrew Luck, and I and many others got fired in the process. That was certainly not deliberate. As a matter of fact, we won because of a great coaching job by Jim Caldwell and staff. We won the last two games of the regular season. In fact, knocked Houston out of the playoffs. So we were going for whatever good we could come out of that season right to the very end. And I'm proud of that. I'm not proud of 2-14, but I'm proud that our guys played hard the whole way and our coaches coached hard the whole way. And that's the way it should be. But unfortunately, in this world of Wall Street and metrics and all the rest of that stuff, that's not the game you and I grew up with anymore. But if they want to fix it, the way to do it is through a draft lottery.
Yeah, I'd say that's all very important, very interesting, Bill. And I think, according to what you said, it's important to separate the two. But they're both not only distasteful, but if the one allocation is that someone was paid by the loss, which I can't imagine happening. I can't buy that at all. Then that's more than serious. We're talking about something entirely different and detrimental to everyone involved in sports, certainly the National Football League, which a lot of people would like to do. It's the popularity, the television and otherwise is really at a peak right now. It's amazing. What, as you see things evolving, Bill, in the league, and I know you've had a chance to maybe step back and just take a look at the whole game of football itself, and you know we've got the greatest followers in the world in football. They're all follow the leader. If an administration, an owner, the media points out somebody doing something that they feel is advantageous or helping them win, then every owner wants to do the same thing. If it's hiring an 18-year-old coach or a 22-year-old coach to win, then they'll go hire a 22-year-old coach. It's just absolutely amazing. And that trend tends to, and that's been going on for a long time. It's not something new, but it tends to be happening again here with just a series of what are their credentials and where did they come from?
Well, I think, as you know, things run in cycles in the National Football League. Again, let's separate the two issues. One, the game on the field, and two, the hiring practices. Whether or not Coach Flores is correct in his assertions, we still don't have the hiring practices working the way we'd like them to work. Now, I think the number is, I'm correct on this number, don't hold me to it, because I heard it yesterday and didn't write it down. But I believe in the last 20 years, we've had 23 black coaches. So the Rooney Rule worked up until a few years ago. So we tweaked it this year, and out of it came two minority general managers and apparently two minority coaches. Now, the issue in my mind for the development of minority coaches is really simple. As Coach Levy used to say, what it takes to win is simple, but it isn't easy. This does not require rocket science. It doesn't require people from outside the NFL to solve the problem. It doesn't require government intervention. It doesn't require geniuses from with PhDs and MBAs in human resources to figure it out. We've got the right model, which is the military. It's worked before in the National Football League. It's not working now, that's all, because there's a trend, as you correctly point out, toward younger coaches from staffs who have won because owners think there's some magic potion that they bring with them, which, of course, is not true. You and I know that isn't true at all. So the way to handle it is to get more minority coordinators, particularly on the offensive side of the ball, in the pipeline and get them coached up and trained up to become head coaches, just like the military takes their promising young officers and puts them through any number of schools, the War College, Command and General Staff School, et cetera, before they ascend to the top ranks of the military. That's point one. We need to do that. And the way we did that years ago with the Stanford program that Bill Walsh and Paul Tagliabue and myself and many others championed. So we could do that again and should. Secondly, we need to get more entry-level minorities into the NFL, particularly on the offensive side of the ball. They come in as interns. They come in as coaching assistants. They come in as quality control coaches, whatever name you want to give to that position. It is not a full-time coaching position. It's an analyst position. It's an adjunct position. It's an entry-level position. It needs to be filled better with minorities on the front end. We did that in scouting, many of us, voluntarily, and in the case of the Indianapolis Colts, I told our personnel people, go find me and us the brightest Ivy League football player you can find who can come in here and we can help upgrade our scouting staff. And they came up with Andrew Berry, who's now the very successful general manager of the Cleveland Browns. So it can be done, and it has been done on the scouting side. All it needs to do is be replicated on the coaching side. And it'll take a couple of years, but that'll solve the problem. I did the coaching search for the and GM search for the Chicago Bears this year. I helped set up the process and help lead it. And in so doing, I came up with 10 minority nine minority coaches who should be at the top of the list next year as interviewees. Now, that's from someone that understands the business, that's hired coaches before, that has interviewed coaches as recently as 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, excuse me. And I can tell you there's plenty of highly qualified minority coaches in the pipeline who are probably going to get a chance next year and should get a chance next year. And I'm going to promote them as best I can. So the bottom line is that the problem is easily soluble. You just have to have the will to do it and the will to implement some changes. There have already been changes to the Rooney Rule, which is great. They've worked tremendously well. There are some other changes that we need to make, I think, in order to be fair to coaches who are in the divisional round of the playoffs. It's very hard for them to coach and develop game plans for the ultimate games of the year and then have to interview for head coaching jobs. You wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't want to do it. And yet we require them to. So that rule needs to change. And we need to push it back. so that the coaches in the divisional round are not burdened with having to interview. So that part, but that's a tweak. We don't need so-called experts from the outside to come in and help us do a job we've already done well. We've already hired a number, not now, not this year, but in the past. The Rooney Rule has worked, and it can work again. All we need is the will to do it.
Well, you know, Bill, our bottom line with me is whoever is qualified, it should be on qualification only. I really have a problem with someone being advanced because of their race, their color, or whatever. Everything
should be based on quality. That's not what I'm advocating at all. I'm advocating advancing people into the pipeline based on, to some degree, on race. But after that, it's on merit the rest of the way. Because we don't have enough people in the pipeline. But once you're in the pipeline, it's on merit the rest of the way. And what the media and all of the professional politicians that are making all this noise either don't know, I suspect they don't, or don't choose to deal with it. They don't know enough about our business to have an informed opinion, the vast majority of them, don't recognize that there are only 32 jobs as head coaches in the National Football League. And not every person who works in the National Football League as an assistant coach is going to have the capability to do that job. It's
that's
the
right.
Dream comes to the top.
Right.
And that's the way it should be.
Bill, by the way, before we get into the Super Bowl here quickly, oddly enough, we have Vic Carucci coming on tomorrow. And Vic was telling me that you have a book coming out here right away, the two of you. And so that's something that's very interesting. I know that you put in a lot of work on it. I know how you do those things. So when is the book coming out? The release on it?
Well, it's out now. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Triumph Books in Chicago, Illinois, and you can get it at many of your local bookstores. And it's called Super Bowl Blueprint. And what we did was study some of the greatest teams of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and talk to their coaches and owners, general managers, and players. Many of them are Hall of Famers, and it's an oral history. And there's tales from the locker room and tales from the boardroom and tales about trades and drafts. And it's many, many stories that people have never heard before. We had a ball doing it. We talked to well over 40 people, and we budgeted an hour each for the interviews, and we didn't have one that didn't last less than 90 minutes. So everybody was really anxious to talk, and it was phenomenal. It was really great.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, I think anybody would enjoy it. So that's Blueprint to Super Bowl Blueprint, right?
Yeah, Super Bowl Blueprint.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will get out and get it, you bet. All right, let's talk about the game coming up here. We got, which I think is extremely interesting. Personally, I'll tell you, I hate it that Tom Brady is retiring. For just to watch a game and watch the perfection of the best to ever do it. And there's no question about that.
You're sure.
I hate that I'm not going to be able to watch him play again next year. But it happened this year, crazy. But 13 seconds left, you would have thought. But at any rate, we've got the two left, the Rams and the Bengals. Interesting matchup, certainly because of the quarterback situation on both teams. Joe Brady, the youngster, only two years out, only in his second year. First year was marred by injury. I think he's done a heck of a job. I just hope his offensive line can hold up well enough for this to be a ball game. And then, of course, Los Angeles, where you've got the old QB, who, quite frankly, has always had good skills, the measurables, the strong arm, and the accuracy in most cases, and many of the things you look for in a quarterback. And now he's got his opportunity with a good football team. So how do you see this Super Bowl, Rams and Bengals?
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting game. You hit the nail right on the head. I think the team that protects its quarterback best and is able to run the ball best is the team that's going to win the game. The two offensive lines are really the weakest part of both teams. There are some holes in both groups. In Cincinnati, it's the tackles. Although, to their credit and to the coaching staff's credit, neither one of them is fast or rangy or had great feet, but they rarely get beaten on the inside, which, of course, as you know, Kay, you know, you can, if you get beat to the outside, you can sometimes push the rusher by the quarterback, or the quarterback can step up in the pocket and deliver the ball. It's when you get rushed, when you get beaten from the to the inside as a tackle, there are real problems. But those two guys have to hold up for the Bengals in order for the Bengals to win. The same is true of the Rams. The Rams' left guard is a liability. Their right tackle is Haberstein is okay, but he has trouble with speed rushers, as does Whitworth on the other side. The media never talks about both of those situations. They talk about the 9 sacks that occurred in the Bengal-Tennessee Titan game, but they don't know why they occurred. And in the Rams' case, they simply don't talk about it because there are more interesting stories for them to talk about, and that's their business. But when it's football, the offensive lines are the weakest parts of both teams. So whichever one plays the best against two very good rush fronts, the Bengals' rush front is really good. People don't know that because you don't see them on television. And the talking heads on the shows that go on Monday to Friday don't talk about them. But they are really good. Hendrickson can rush the passer. So can Hubbard. Between them, they have 5.5 sacks in the playoffs. They're both power rushers. They're not speed guys. The Rams guys, Floyd and the kid that came over from Denver, are really excellent speed rushers. DJ Reader is a guy to keep your eye on. BJ Hill is a guy to keep your eye on for the Bengals. They're good players. And they have the capacity to make life miserable. And the Rams' offensive line has to hold up. As I said, their left guard's been very suspect throughout, and both tackles have a little difficulty with speed. So we'll see how those matchups go. Von Miller is obviously the guy on the other side that they picked up, that the Rams did, that is a great rusher. Situationally, he doesn't play every down, but he's a great situational rusher. The ability to run the ball is going to be really important. Cam Akers, if he can play, and that's we don't know as we speak today what his status will be, is the guy that has to be in there for the Rams. If he's not, if it's just Sony Michel, it's an uphill battle for them, because Joe Mixon, albeit averaging 4.1 yards a carry during the regular season, really has juice. He has he can shake and bake, and he's 222 pounds. He can blast with you. So he is the best back in the game. And if he can have a big day, the Bengals can win. There's no two ways about it. I think the receiving cores kind of cancel each other out. They're both great. Cooper Kupp, Van Jefferson, Odell Beckham, who is a he's a virtuoso. You know, he's an outside-the-box receiver. By that, I mean he can run two lousy routes and then run a great one and make a one-handed catch and score a touchdown. The guy's got ability oozing from every pore in his body. And he gets a lot of single coverage because Cooper Kupp is so great. Cooper Kupp is, for my money, best receiver in the National Football League. He's great after the catch. He's a great route runner. He's a great blocker. They actually use him to chip in pass protection, and they do a lot to get him open. And he's obviously Stafford's favorite guy. But he's a great, great receiver. And Beckham was a great addition. And he can make the spectacular plays, particularly in the red zone and down the field because of the great speed. And Van Jefferson's a really solid player. But on the other side, on the Bengals side, Ja'Marr Chase is the Cooper Kupp of the NFC, of the AFC, and you know, will emerge, I'm sure, as the number one receiver in the AFC very shortly, if he hasn't already. T. Higgins is and Tyler Boyd are great additions to that core. T. Higgins is growing and getting better, and he's got, you know, length and speed to catch. Tyler Boyd is a very good possession receiver. We don't know if their tight end, Uzama, will play because he was injured in the championship game. If he can't, that's a big loss for the Bengals because he's really a good player. Tyler Higbee for the Rams at tight end is really a good player, and he too was banged up a little bit, but I think he's going to make I give the Bengals an edge at running back. The receiving cores are about equal. And then it comes down to the defenses and the quarterbacks. Stafford's having a great year. I've always believed that he's a really good player. He's now got the chance to show it because he's playing with a really good skill set group that he's never had before. The Lions were a wasteland, except for the 2 years that, or 3 years that Jim Caldwell coached them. And then there was them, of course, they fired him and created another dumpster fire. But he's a really good player. I think in Burrow, you're looking at a young Peyton Manning, which is really saying something, especially since I spent 14 years with Peyton Manning. I think he's got many of the same qualities. He's got that clutch gene. He's got that football gene because he's the son of a coach, as Archie was the son of a player. I think he's grown up around the game, he's very special. And we found out in the championship game, he's a pretty damn good runner too. I didn't know that. He didn't have to. Someone said to me, he didn't have to do it at LSU. that matchup is pretty darn close, and I think the guy who plays the best at that position is going to be his team will win the game, and that's entirely dependent on how the offensive lines, the respective offensive lines, play.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think they've Cincinnati's got a sure they was up. You know, I see some things every week. I'll watch ball games and. Good Lord, I see things that if we had allowed to happen when I was coaching, Chuck Knox would have fired me. I mean, just turning people loose, no protection whatsoever, and simple using just simple slides rather than a more sophisticated the Rose Lily type protections that that came along. Anyway, that's just food for thought. Amazing to me that some of these things are just so evident, so poorly done, really poor recognition and poor adherence to technique to take care of them. Let me ask you a quick question here. You mentioned Jim Caldwell. I've mentioned Caldwell's name a couple of times. I thought he did a good job at Indianapolis, and then did the last coach to win at Detroit, and got fired. What's his situation? I would have thought that he would have been back in the firmly back in the mix for a head job.
Well, I thought so too, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. We'll find out, you know, who some of the other people hired ahead of him, and we'll see, you know, how they work out. But there's no question in my mind that he's an outstanding head coach, and he's proven it. And you know, but it didn't work out because, as you said at the outset of the show, everybody's looking for the flavor of the month, which is I thought you phrased it.
Great performance in that league. Listen, Bill, we're going to have to run. I can't thank you enough for coming on with us. And as always, we get down around the combine and draft and so on. I'd love to have you on as much as we can. Appreciate it.
Okay. I look forward to it. Thank you.